This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the last day of 2007, we take a look at some of the most significant stories that have affected our civil liberties.
From the magnificent failure on impeachment, to the continued funding of Iraq and Afghanistan, to the torture story, to Guantanamo, to warrantless wiretapping, to domestic surveillance, and a Supreme Court that seems to have followed law into the netherworld, we're pulling together these stories for you on Law and Disorder.
We'll hear an acceptance speech from our own co-host, Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael received the 2007 Puffin Nation Prize for Creative Citizenship. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today, we look at the stories that have taken civil liberties in this country many steps in the wrong direction. We start with the question of impeachment. What happened? Why it stalled? We'll look at damaging Supreme Court decisions and draconian legislation that took a large bite out of the right to free speech and dissent in this country.
That's right, Heidi. We'll start with what we're calling the magnificent failure on impeachment. As our second story, we'll go to the continued outrage of war funding for Iraq and Afghanistan. Continued funding despite the Democratic control of the House and the Senate. Our third story will be the torture story. Really the torture story 5, 6, 7 years old, but this was a really bad year on the torture story, from Mukasey to destruction of CIA tapes. Our fourth story will be something we've been covering since we began, the continuation of the Guantanamo offshore prison camp, another argument in the Supreme Court about it, but in the end, we still have Guantanamo. Our fifth story is warrantless wiretapping, the president's claim that he can warrantlessly wiretap American citizens and Congress's weak-kneed, spineless reaction to that assertion. Our sixth story is about domestic surveillance. Of course, our fifth story, warrantless wiretapping, is related, but our sixth story concerns the Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, not yet passed. Unfortunately, it will be. And the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act of 2007, putting the military and Blackwater on the streets of our cities. Not a great sign. Our seventh story is about the new Supreme Court. 3-5, what the New York Times called a trifecta of bad decisions. A bad decision on free speech, a bad decision on challenging violations of separation of church and state, and a bad decision on campaign financing. 3-5, 3 decisions cutting back our rights. Our A story we separated out from our earlier piece on the Supreme Court because it really goes to the core of a major issue in this country, and that's the issue of race and racism, what Du Bois called the color line as being the problem of the 20th century and now the problem of the 21st. In a 5-4 decision, again, the Supreme Court struck down plans to integrate high schools in Kentucky and Washington, a real reversal of a decision made 4 years ago in the University of Michigan case, and really an undercutting of the very premise of integration that made Brown v. Board the great 1954 decision. As our ninth story, we at least have something that's a little brighter, in a way. We have the crack cocaine story, and finally, the Supreme Court doing something, a very little bit, but something, about bringing closer together the outrageous sentences that have been given for crack versus the lesser sentences that have been given for powdered cocaine. Again, at the heart of this story is the issue of race. And finally, our 10th story, so you hear the top 10, most of them bad, but occasional little spots of brightness, was the end of the death penalty in New Jersey. Major story, first time a state has outlawed the death penalty since 1976, and we hope it's the beginning of a wave that takes at least that part of this country's inhumanity off the page of inhumanity.
John Nirenberg, he's walking 465 miles from New England down Highway 1 to talk to Nancy Pelosi, tell her to impeach Bush. Congratulations for doing this. It's really a terrific thing.
We're really excited to talk to you. You're actually on the walk right now. Is that right?
Yeah, we started at 125th Street. We're now at 66th Street. It's gone like a breeze. It's something else to be walking down Broadway, I'll tell you.
John, how did you get involved? What motivated you to take this long walk?
The truthful answer is I've been in a fog of complacency for a long time, but I was reading a book in preparation I was teaching in organizational behavior, and the book was called The Lucifer Effect, How Good People Do Evil. And to make a long story short, it was about an analysis of the Stanford prison experiments and the Abu Ghraib experience in Iraq. And when I finished reading that book, the startling truth that emerged was that while people can have some idea of their own dignity and withdraw from unsavory circumstances perpetrated by a system, the fact of the matter is the system is the problem. And when I realized this, I couldn't sit still any longer, that the United States of America was perpetrating torture, was violating the constitutional rights of American citizens as well by taking people literally off the street for 3-4 years, and torturing them in the process. I mean, this was just a wake-up call for me, and I knew I couldn't just sit there. Oh, gee, that's terrible. I had to do something. What I'm startled with right now is why I'm not meeting hundreds and thousands of people along the way who are marching with me, but that's another story.
Yeah, well, you're going to be talking to a lot of them through Law and Disorder, John. What do you have to say to them?
We need to make this a public awareness campaign so that Republican, independent, Democrat, doesn't matter who you are, Americans everywhere need to know that the Constitution is literally endangered here to the point where if impeachment doesn't take place, it's in my opinion that the Constitution will be then forever altered.
John, are people stopping you as you've been walking? Are they asking you questions? What do you say to them?
People are engaging us in conversation, and some are congratulating us. Most people are avoiding us like we're carrying nuclear waste or something.
Paint the scene for me. Do you have signs on? Are there a group of people with you? What do you wear?
Yeah, I started with a walking companion from Faneuil Hall in Boston. That's where Sam Adams planned the revolution. That's where abolitionists spoke. That's where civil rights advocates spoke. That's the hotbed of New England progressive thinking. It was very symbolic for me. It was a touching moment, actually, to then do a ceremonial walk to the site of the Boston Tea Party, whose anniversary was December 16th. So I hit the road, and through storms, through rain, snow, sleet, you name it, we just kept on moving. We have a sign that I carry, Save the Constitution, Impeach Bush Cheney. And here's the message. Tell Speaker Pelosi, call her, 202-225-0100. Let her know you support the impeachment process. If you can just use your finger, please.
I can use my finger.
Will you use your feet?
And we'll use our finger. 202-225-0100. Call him. Right. Impeach Bush.
Yeah, and go to the website, sign a petition, and it's really a painless thing. And if you do that, I'll really feel like I'm marching in your name as well. And I'd just love to do that. Marchinmyname.org.
Great. All of us at Law and Disorder wish you the best with success.
It's actually a thrilling up to talk to you, considering we've been going through like some of the 10 disasters of the year, you know, from torture to Guantanamo to the Iraq funding. I think your real key question is, but why aren't there thousands out with you?
This one issue, impeachment, will settle almost 9 of those other 10, I'm sure.
I agree.
Good
point. 100%.
You guys are great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
Having me on your show. Thanks.
Michael, legally speaking, what are the grounds to impeach Bush?
You know, this one's a slam dunk, Michael. You know, there's an impeachment clause. It's high crimes and misdemeanors. High crimes and misdemeanors, which came out of the Constitution in the early days, hold over from United Kingdom or England. doesn't mean crimes. It really means subversion of the Constitution. That's the key thing to remember, subversion of the Constitution, not faithfully executing the laws. The grounds are very clear. If you talk about subversion of the Constitution, you can just start. You start with, you know, the Fifth Amendment right to due process. Due process means you have a right essentially to habeas corpus, a court hearing. You have the habeas corpus is in the Constitution, clearly subverted. Fourth Amendment, protecting wiretapping in the Constitution, clearly subverted. All over the place. I mean, you can go from, take out a list of paper, as your school teacher used to say, a number from 1 to 100, and fill in the blanks. Lying to the American people about Iraq.
I mean, destroying evidence in the form of videotapes documenting torture.
I mean, this makes, you know, certainly the Clinton so-called impeachment look like a complete nothing. I mean, which it was, but
yeah.
Ridiculous. And the fact that the Democrats said early on we're taking it off the table, and Pelosi said that, and we're going to only look forward and not backward, is really an outrage, because without accountability for what has gone before, one, it's a license for the future to continue those kind of practices from torture to Guantanamo. Secondly, it means that the next president, I don't care Democrat or Republican, is going to use those very executive powers that essentially have set up the trappings, if not more, of a police state in this country.
Impeachment, I want our audience to understand, doesn't mean conviction. Impeachment's the trial. All they're going to do is put them up there, and then the information is going to come out, and that's what we want. We want this laundry out there.
Well, the impeachment is the House votes articles of impeachment, and that's called impeachment. And then there's a trial on those articles in the Senate where it takes, I think, two-thirds to convict.
If we were senators, they got our vote.
That's for sure. And this is a great, you know, the effort from John is just really, really exciting. I mean, there's a lot going on all over the country. As he said, the majority of people, high majority, are supporting it. And I think that's true across the country. The high majority of people want some kind of proceedings brought. I mean, this has been a government that has really just plowed the Constitution underground. Without impeachment proceedings, it's probably going to stay underground.
Gore Vidal calls it the oil gas junta.
One other troubling aspect of this is, Michael, you just said that so many people in this country support it. Well, why aren't our elected representatives listening to us and doing something about it? They are condoning illegality, and they're not listening to the voices of the American public. That's a problem.
That's right. They're not listening on impeachment. They're not listening on the war in Iraq. They're not listening on wiretap. They're not listening on torture. Even the New York Times said, looks like they're from the same party as the Republicans.
Continuing our look at some of the major developments that have occurred this year, we go to continued war funding in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Michael, there's been a new development in terms of funding. What's happened?
Heidi, I wish I could say it was a new development. You know, we did have some probably overblown expectations when the Democrats took control of the House and the Senate that we might see a cutback in the Iraq war funding, a cutback in the troops, the beginning of withdrawal, some kind of conditions put on some of the funding. But what we've seen is not only the surge this year, so-called surge, the escalation is the better word for it.
Surge in troops, you mean?
Surge in troops, maybe 50,000, they said 30,000, but if you include support, it's probably who knows how many. Really an escalation, I wouldn't call it a surge. And we've seen the Democrats fold, fold, and fold. It's like an origami, you know, paper thing where you keep folding and the Democrats keep making more folds. So that on this latest one that happened in this last December, again, the House buckled, the Senate buckled, and billions more money are going to Iraq without even a peep about pulling even one soldier out of Iraq. They're not even pulling out the short order cook, you know, who's way behind the lines. Nobody. So we've seen the Democrats, despite being elected with the purpose and really with the electorate saying, get us the heck out of Iraq, really actually caving completely. And in fact, on this latest one, I heard from some congressmen that they were willing to vote on the Iraq funding measure in the House, but there were a whole bunch of conditions on withdrawal, and supposedly Pelosi said, I'm going to leave that in, and then she, behind their back, I think, just pulled it out and went forward without any conditions. Now, I know Michael Smith also has some ideas here about, particularly, Michael, how much money do you think we've spent on Iraq?
The high estimates are about $1.5 trillion, which is a number that I can't even imagine. It's like how many stars are in the left part of the sky. But
if you put the dollars end to end, where would
what
that
does it get us?
The moon, moon or the Mars?
What could we do with that money?
Well, first of all, you could protect New Orleans against another wave. You could build some bridges in Minnesota. I mean, the whole infrastructure of this country is falling down, not just the bricks and steel. Education. can't go to college anymore. Harvard is giving scholarships to kids whose parents make $180,000 a year because those kids can't even go to college.
And it's what like about cutbacks that they're talking about in anti-terrorism measures for New York especially? They're cutting back the money, and yet they're saying we have a war on terrorism.
So Iraq has really hurt us. It's hurt Iraq, obviously, the most. $1 trillion, as Michael says. How many zeros does a trillion have after it?
Well, I don't know. A million has got six. So a billion has got nine. So a trillion has got 12 zeros.
So this is a really, really bad sign. All it means is there's huge protests going on in Washington and otherwise to try and change this. But the Democrats proving once again that there's not much difference on this issue between the two parties.
No, I think it's a bipartisan foreign policy, actually. And when you keep probing, why do they do it? I think they do it because they want to perpetuate themselves in office and for the power, and they've got to raise the money. Wall Street's given more money now to the Democrats than to the Republicans. They're in an apparatus where how much does a senator have to raise every week to stay there, like $30,000?
Well, speaking of Iraq, something that few people may know about is that this July, on the 17th, the president passed executive order blocking property of certain persons who threaten ICE stabilization efforts in Iraq. This is clearly another presidential step taking his own authority to criminalize dissent, so that in the worst case scenario, if someone protests, say, the war in Iraq, this means that the president can empower himself to seize the assets of persons violating this decree. Who knew?
I mean, it's really a nasty piece of business.
We've talked about signing statements on this show, something that President Bush has excelled at doing, sort of letting him leave his own mark on a piece of legislation so that it may be interpreted differently in history. Essentially, President Bush has issued over 250 executive orders, and definitely there will be more to come. The Constitution doesn't have a provision giving the president power to make new law through such one-person executive order decrees, and yet, in true to his form, President Bush has been issuing these. And again, not receiving much attention, but continuing to chisel away at our precious Constitution.
He's given more executive orders than all other presidents in American history combined.
Combined.
So think about it, guys. You have broad Iraq funding by Democrats and Republicans. Then you have a law that basically tries to limit people who try and do something against that funding in a certain way. So you're really talking about a very, very nasty situation. It's one that I want to just encourage people on. I think all of us do. This is probably the critical issue facing this country today, is permanent war and getting ourselves out of Iraq and out of the rest of being the world's policeman. So this is it.
Speaking of issues that have informed really everything we've talked about on Law and Disorder for several years is the issue of torture. Waterboarding has been in the news recently, especially with the destruction of the CIA tapes. And now it's coming out, of course, that government counsel and the higher-ups actually knew about the destruction of the tapes and possibly advised them to be destroyed.
Possibly? What do you think about that, Michael? Possibly?
Well, there's no issue here. In fact, every day there's more and more. My first being, all of us, I think, are very upset that instead, of course, of going after the water torture itself, or what happened, they're now, you know, dealing with this business of destruction of tapes. And if it's the usual course in our Congress, the Democrats and the Republicans will essentially cave in the end and it'll be swept away. But so far, it's still in a live, hot controversy. But on the issue of getting advice, of course they got advice. In fact, today it came out that conceivably Bush, Cheney, Addington may have been involved in giving advice. And then it came out to what really we've been saying for a long time. Everybody says, oh, they destroyed these. I heard I was on with a Times reporter. He said, they destroyed them because if they fell into the wrong hands, can you imagine how upset the Muslim world would be?
What?
And I said to that guy, that's BS. They destroyed these to protect themselves from prosecution. And today it came out. They were destroyed in 2005. At the end of 2004, beginning of 2005, they redefined torture again a little more broadly so that it might arguably have included what was on these tapes. The CIA people got very nervous about prosecution because now all of a sudden there's a different view of torture. It could cover that. And that is when they just made the decision, apparently, with even people like Chertoff, who was at the Justice Department, who was Homeland Security, going in on this issue of getting rid of these hundreds of hours of tapes, hundreds of hours.
Which is a criminal act Correct. Now, Mukasey's not going to do anything about this. Could a special prosecutor be appointed if they really wanted, if we apply pressure?
Well, there's all these issues out there. One is there's Mukasey doing an investigation, and as our own Marge Cohn from the National Lawyers Guild has written, he's conflicted out. Mukasey, when he was a judge, actually signed an order, a material witness warrant for Jose Padilla that may well have been based on torture. We don't know torture of Zubeda, who was on these tapes. We don't know if he knew about that at the time, but certainly DOJ people most likely knew about it. In our own Guantanamo cases, there's orders of preservation about these very kinds of tapes. In fact, there's a hearing is continuing in Washington on this. In the Musawi case, there was a request on the tapes. So the CIA must have been so desperate about prosecution that it appears they actually destroyed these tapes in the face of knowing that it was illegal to do so and that courts wanted them.
What's so amazing is that they made the tapes to begin with. They've got hundreds of hours of tapes that would prove conclusive evidence that they committed crimes, international crimes, domestic crimes, crimes that could send them to prison forever. And even if any of these people died as a consequence of the torture, which is probably likely, it would yield the death penalty. And they kept these tapes anyway.
Well, Michael, I think that's interesting that they kept them for 3 years. And I speculate that they kept them to show to other people who they had in prison, other people they'd kidnapped around the world, to say, if you look, first of all, one of your, I don't think Zubeda was that high up, but whoever they want to show it to, and they say, look, he's already given up names. He's given up stuff. This is going to happen to you unless you cooperate with us, or this is going to happen to you unless, or we're going to reveal this tape even to Zubeda, make you informants, or whatever they do with these tapes. There was a reason they kept these things for 3 years, Michael. I agree.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you know, this is a bigger topic, of course. We're talking about the tapes now, but it's really been a bad year for those of us who oppose torture. First, I mean, one of the highlights, certainly, if you want to call it a highlight or a lowlight, is the confirmation of Mukasey, who couldn't decide whether waterboarding was torture. And you know what? I've come to lately that there's people who deny that the United States tortures, and then there's people who try and say, well, we need to torture in this particular time. And I've decided, of course, both should be in Dante's hell, but the Ninth Circle should probably be reserved for the people who actually try and justify it. The people who deny we're torturing, at least they believe there's something wrong with torturing, even though they're lying about it and giving a bad definition. But the people who actually justify it, those guys, the lowest of the low.
The French always hid their torture. They were ashamed of it. But the United States has gone and won better.
That's really, I think, Michael, I think that puts your finger right on it. And so that's why this whole torture program, scandal, conspiracy, really goes deep into the moral, legal roots of our country. I mean, it's a really sad, sad moment.
And one of the things that we've also discussed over the past couple of years is how, in terms of human rights violations, many other countries look to the United States for our track record on human rights violations. And by our condoning torture as blatantly as we have, I think we send a really troubling message to other countries that, well, the U.S. does it. They do it continuously. They have extraordinary renditions, waterboarding, and so, hey, it's okay for us to do it as well.
They do it domestically, too. That's a hidden story.
And we've covered that on the show with Chicago,
yeah.
Right, Mark?
They're designed by psychiatrists to isolate people and subject them to sensory deprivation, which that's exactly what they're doing overseas, and they do it domestically too. They've got 2.3 million people in prison, and a lot of them are in these Maximax prisons where the human psyche breaks down very quickly when they're deprived of any human contact. They do it intentionally in this country too.
And I do think as we close this little segment on torture, we want to bring people the perspective that we did on our show 2 weeks ago with Marnia Lazarin and her book, which is called
Torture in the Twilight of Empire, from Algiers to Baghdad.
And I want to recommend people going back and listening to that show. The date of that show is December 17th. You can go to our website. The key thing that she said was looking at torture not as just a way of getting information, etc., but is really one declining civilization, whether the French in Algeria or the United States in Iraq, really trying to put forth a very aggressive, vengeful view toward the other, in this case the other being Muslims in Iraq, and of course the French being Muslims in Algeria, and carrying with you into the torture chambers all those assumptions about, quote, Western civilization being attacked by Muslims, essentially.
Michael, speaking as Marnia did so eloquently in her book about the decline of empire, there are many other areas in which this country has shown that it is declining in front of our very faces. We have Guantanamo and the Supreme Court arguments that were recently held in which the Center for Constitutional Rights is involved. And we've talked about Guantanamo for years. That, along with torture, to me represents so symbolically and poignantly the declination of our empire.
Michael, since you were down in Washington recently at the Supreme Court argument, can you give us a retrospective of what's developed with Guantanamo over the last year?
Well, as people, our listeners know, this is the sixth year coming to the sixth year of Guantanamo, and it's completely off the wall and outrageous. And one question you want to ask yourself is, now we're down to about 290. The center and its lawyers, 600 of us out there, have gotten about half the people out, which is a plus, but of course no one's ever had a court hearing. But it still exists, and you have to understand that it still exists in the face of President Bush saying 3 or 4 years ago, I want to close it. Gates, the Secretary of Defense, saying, I want to close it. So if they want to close it, why don't they close it and put the people where they could go, in other countries, the United States, etc.? The obvious reason, and it fits what we were talking about with torture, in some way they want to keep Guantanamo open, because Guantanamo represents, for the United States and the world, what will happen to you if you oppose the United States in any way. We will send you to Guantanamo and then torture you. And it's not really about information. It's really about macho or vengeance or empire. It's really about keeping that place open as a means of saying the United States is a powerful fist, is the best way to say it. And so that's why I think we haven't been able to close it. Now, this year, of course, we've gotten some people out. We've had the Supreme Court argument the third time, and we won twice in the Supreme Court. Now we're on the core issue of the constitutionality of taking away the right to go to court from people, the right of habeas. And, you know, the argument was tricky. You have four people who are really not worthy of the name justice in this case. You have four who are moderates to liberals, and you have Justice Kennedy in the middle. And that'll decide whether they're going to really, what I would say, cut the Gordian knot that has tied us up for 6 years at Guantanamo and say these people have a right to a hearing. If they do that and we get a right to a hearing, there won't be hearings because most of the people will be released. There's no evidence. What evidence there is from torture, even from the guy who was tortured on those tapes. A not great opinion would be remanding it back to the lower courts and letting us muck around in the lower courts for another 2 years and essentially handing the problem to the Democrats, which will not necessarily be to great benefit.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. If you're just tuning into Law and Disorder, we're taking a look at some of the stories that have taken civil liberties in this country many steps in the wrong direction. Guantanamo has clearly been a huge issue in terms of everything it represents, including the fact that lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who've been heavily involved in Guantanamo litigation, suspect that their telephone conversations and may be monitored by the government. And this comes under some changes to the FISA laws that have long been in place. Again, a lessening of protections of our rights. And now it's going after attorneys and their privileged conversations with clients.
I mean, FISA, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, has a really bad history under the Bush administration. It was originally set up as a secret court to give warrants secretly for wiretapping for foreign intelligence purposes. But still, people like the three of us here, Michael, Heidi, and myself, had to get a warrant in a regular federal court. You couldn't go to a secret court for doing that because it was a domestic wiretapping law. And while we had our ball on that, the president basically signed an order that allowed warrantless wiretapping of everybody he wanted to, including not just wiretapping of phones, but all this stuff with the internet and all these telephone companies that cooperated with it and all that. So he basically, after going to Congress, he hid the ball and then allowed warrantless wiretapping. When that was discovered by the James Risen article in the New York Times, there was a furor about it. What's going on here? But of course, Congress did zip. And what they did this year, very sadly, was they passed a bill, a temporary bill with a sunset provision for 6 months that essentially allowed the president to continue what I consider to be, and most of us do, an unlawful, illegal authority to continue to do warrantless wiretapping. And now that six-month sunset, it sunsets in February of 2008. And the question in the Congress this at the end of this year is, what are they going to do? Are we going to go back to the old original good law, that not good necessarily, but one that at least said you couldn't just warrantlessly wiretap Michael Smith, Michael Ratner, and Heidi Boghossian, but you had to at least go to a court to get that warrant? And right now, I would have to say that it looks bad.
You know, when the Times came out with that article, they sat on that story for a year, and they only came out with the article because Risen's book was about to be published. The telephone companies have asked now for amnesty, and I think the government's going to grant it to them. So there's going to be nobody prosecuted for snooping on us.
Meaning amnesty, they can't be sued by individuals.
Yeah. Here you have the government spying on a law office that's trying to defend people, tapping their phones, getting into their computers.
These legal organizations can't really fully defend their case because everything's secret. And the government's answer is, well, they can't prove that they're being wiretapped or monitored.
But think about that. There's a number of things going on right now this year. One was all the suits against the telephone companies. And what the push by the telephone companies is, as you said, is to give them an amnesty and dismiss all the lawsuits. There's, I think, 33 lawsuits, maybe more, against these phone companies by various people. And the objection is not just to give them immunity or amnesty. The real objection is, what is the Congress doing getting into the court's business? Whether those phone companies have a good defense or not, we don't even have to decide. Let it up to the courts. But the idea that the Congress is essentially coming in and making the court's decision is remarkable. Michael, let's say one of your lawsuits, when you sue somebody for, you know, being run over, and the Congress comes in and they
special
say,
bill.
Well, special bill to immunize that person. So that's really what they're doing here. It's incredible to
and
me.
And it's also the influence. It shows the influence of big corporations in our lives, the telecommunication companies lobbying against this. We also had gun makers want immunity in gun-related cases, tobacco. Everyone wants immunity.
And look, they have a nice name for this new statute, the Protect America Act of 2007.
And they always have those Orwellian
names. What should we call
right.
it? The Protect Verizon Act. Or protect
AT&T.
The AT&T, Protect the Phone Companies Act of 2007. And it also gives much more authority for warrantless wiretapping. I mean, it's a nasty, nasty piece of business.
Another piece of really bad legislation became effective at the end of 2006, but it was labeled the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2007. This was a huge piece of law that essentially amended the Insurrection Act of 1807 and the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 that prohibit using federal and National Guard troops for law enforcement domestically, except as constitutionally allowed or authorized by Congress in times of national emergency. This is Blackwater coming to rule the streets of the cities.
There already were a lot of exceptions to the Posse Comitatus Act. It wasn't great. It used to really prohibit any domestic involvement of the military. But obviously those exceptions were not enough for the Bush administration and our fine members of Congress. And they just decided to really essentially open it up to everybody from Blackwater to U.S. troops. So now when you see those cowboy movies, you know, that say, hey, bring out the posse, instead of seeing the locals from the village, we're going to see the Washington sending troops are going to be in the posse.
Heavily armed troops.
Bush can now take, on his own initiative, without consulting the governor, National Guard troops from State A and put them into State B without consulting the governor there either. So Bush can call out the troops on us.
They're not the traditional troops that we used to have. They're from private companies with sort of a vigilante type attitude,
well, that too.
Lack of training, lack of accountability.
two things. It's not only the private armies that they can pay with our taxpayer dollars. The National Guard, it's both. They can use both. If they want, let's say they take the National Guard from New Jersey, they try to bring them in New York, and the people from New Jersey like the people in New York, and they really don't want to put us down, you know, then they can go out and they can hire private troops, get us to pay for them to put us down. It's both.
You know, what's interesting on this issue is Blackwater. You know, we used to always say that, well, you know, we're moving toward police state, fascist state, whatever you want to talk about, but we don't have brown shirts in the street beating up people. And the problem is now, if you ask for what our domestic brown shirts are, they're groups of private security people like the Blackwaters of the world.
Fortunately, we have so many surveillance cameras on every street corner that there will be recordings of the kind of horrible acts they perpetrate against the citizens of New York, for example.
There was a number in the Times the other day that the number of surveillance cameras just downtown, I think south of Canal, was like 3,000.
Yeah.
It wasn't, they're not mostly private, actually. They're not mostly government, like a few hundred are government, but the most of them are private. But essentially, now almost everything is surveilled.
Well, speaking of domestic surveillance and spying on ordinary people in this country, we'd like to bring to listeners' attentions two developments, one, an act of legislation that has been enacted, and the other one that has been proposed. The first is the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2007. The second piece of legislation is proposed right now, the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Protection Act of 2007. This is likely going to pass in 2008.
Let's talk about how the two interact.
The Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Protection Act is something that we've likened here on Law and Disorder to the House Un-American Activities Committees. It will involve setting up committees around the country that will have the power to interrogate and question and pull in individuals who the government thinks may be up to no good in terms of their thoughts, their activities, their internet activities, organizing things, rounding people up for political
movement
purpose.
People who are movement. For progressive social change are now going to get raked over the coals by these committees, just like they did during the HUAC days when they tried to take out the progressive social movement in the country. Tried and succeeded. It's the same thing now. They're setting them up all over the country, and if that doesn't work and they can't repress them that way, they can literally call on the troops, thanks to John Warner.
The third case that the Supreme Court decided in a way we don't agree with is basically about campaign finance reform.
You know, the court has never been great on campaign finance reform because they look at it like they looked, or at least the ACLU certainly for a long time looked at smoking ads, that you have a right essentially under the First Amendment, certainly as an individual, financing your own campaign, to give all the money you want. They bring a First Amendment analysis in here of free speech and free action, essentially. But this case was a surprise because 4 years earlier, they'd actually put restrictions on corporations funding what you would call attack ads on issues, not on candidates, but on issues. But oftentimes those issues are clearly related to a candidate. An attack ad that says no to abortion, no to abortion, and there's a candidate running who's pro-abortion, that really goes to the negative campaigning against that candidate. And what this Supreme Court did, again, 5-4, is all the decisions we've been discussing are 5-4, four essential moderates to liberals on one side, Kennedy in the middle, and the four, what we're only calling the non-human justices, inhuman justices on the other side. They decided that corporations, et cetera, could fund these attack ads on issues essentially in an unlimited way, which really just is putting more and more corporate money, more and more big money into our elections. And even though it's been a dream of people for years to make our elections fairer with in terms of financing, that's what it is. It's a dream.
It's a fiction, though, to say that they treat a corporation like a person. And they say, well, it's a First Amendment right of this corporation to use all their money to attack someone on issues. The fiction is that a corporation is a person, and they give these huge conglomerates of money First Amendment rights.
I think that's a really crucial point, Michael. The idea that corporations should have the same rights and be able to wrap themselves in the rights of the First Amendment in the same way that you and I can really says where power is. And the whole idea of John Mills and the marketplace of ideas and the best ideas winning out, that assumes that there isn't some guy in there who essentially has billions of dollars to influence the marketplace.
We'll see how this plays out in the upcoming elections.
I can make a prediction.
Our next 2007 disconcerting development concerns another of the new Supreme Court's decision. the Brown v. Board of Education case. It involved the use of race to help integrate students into public school systems in this country.
And it concerned two public school systems, one in Seattle and the other in Louisville, Kentucky, and both of them were using race in some way, a factor or otherwise, to try and get some diversity into their school systems. And if people may recall, 4 years before, in the University of Michigan case, the court said that race could be a factor as part of its undergraduate admission process at the University of Michigan. This case, of course, 5-4 again, Kennedy is the swing guy. This case said it could not be in these high schools. And while they're sort of clever lawyers writing these majorities, or certainly the four, they're clever by half because what they said is somehow high schools are different than colleges, and therefore you can't use race. But in effect, they undercut their earlier decision and undercut Brown v. Board.
What they're saying, which is so despicable, using racial consciousness to integrate a school is the moral equivalent of using racial consciousness to segregate a school, and they're both wrong. They rule them out.
Most of the 2007 developments that we've been reviewing have been pretty depressing in nature. There's been one small glimmer of hope, and that is a recent Supreme Court decision that affects judicial discretion in the sentencing guidelines, and that relates to the crack cocaine guidelines.
It does, Heidi. It relates to crack cocaine. It relates to really what we've addressed a fair amount on this program, issues of race in America, because the disparities in sentencing for people using what's called powdered cocaine versus crack cocaine are outrageous. In fact, they're considered, they're 100 times different. I think the rule was if you had 5 grams of crack cocaine and 500 grams of powdered cocaine, only then would you get a similar sentence. And people have been complaining, to put it mildly, for a very long time about this disparity, arguing that it's essentially a racial disparity because more people of color are involved with crack cocaine than they are with powdered cocaine, which is the drug of choice for more white upper-middle-class people or middle-class people. And finally, we had a ruling in the Supreme Court that goes a little bit of ways, not all the way and not close to what we want. Of course, we don't believe in a lot of these drug laws, but goes a little bit of way to remedy that problem.
As the guidelines currently exist, a judge has to impose a certain number of years punishment for a certain crime based on the level of, as you said, the number of grams in possession of the individual. Even if the extenuating circumstances really mitigate that amount for whatever reason, he or she on the bench can't give a lesser sentence. Speaking of mass incarceration, Michael, and we've dealt with this over and over on Law and Disorder in terms of people who are incarcerated for lengthy terms because of low-level drug offenses or nonviolent offenses, another issue we've dealt with is capital punishment and how that's inconsistently applied in this country. I've got to say that one of the most wonderful developments at the end of 2007 was the fact that New Jersey is the first state since 1976 when the death penalty was reinstated in this country. New Jersey has repealed the death penalty in that state, and Governor Corzine actually commuted the sentences
of 8 people, I think, that were on death row.
Exactly. Now they're in with life without parole, but they're not going to face execution. This is something that, after Governor Ryan's courageous act years ago in Illinois, I hope will set the trend for 2008 and that other states will follow in New Jersey's footsteps.
No, it's actually really remarkable. I mean, Ryan in Illinois, of course, commuted the sentences, I think, of a couple of 100 people on death row or more. And they're reformulating the law, whatever it is, and they're not sure they can even make a constitutional law. But this in New Jersey is really significant. I mean, as you said, since 1976, it's the first state that has actually outlawed the death penalty. New York essentially doesn't have a death penalty.
Because they don't really impose it.
They don't impose it, and most of the law has been held unconstitutional, and they don't really think there's necessarily either the will or the ability to draft one that's constitutional. Mm-hmm. So we're moving slowly, really slowly, in the direction of banning the death penalty. But, of course, places like Texas, the Bush state, still has scores, if not more, death
one of the records,
death
yeah.
sentences a
Oklahoma's
year.
Oklahoma's bad, a lot of the southern states.
And I'll never forget, when you think about the United States being behind, I'll never forget getting off a plane in England in 1956. I was a kid, And the headlines of the paper, and I don't know if that was the year or it was another year, but they actually banned it. But either the House of Commons had banned the death penalty in 1956 in the United Kingdom. 51 years later that we got New Jersey to go with
half
this.
Half a century. But, you know, we've talked about torture. We've talked about illegal acts, just numerous, too numerous to list again on the part of the United States government. And I think that in terms of punishment, overreaching of government authority, the death penalty has to be one of the stains on our record as a so-called civilized nation.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And of course, now we have a case in the Supreme Court that's going to be argued this year regarding the way in which the death penalty is administered by drugs and whether that's cruel and unusual.
Lethal injection, right.
Punishment, and that'll be another issue. And they're staying all death penalties now in the Supreme Court because of that. So you could argue there's some progress going on here. But, of course, compared to what we had in 76. In 76, thousands of people on death row, they were all held up, and then they went to the Supreme Court and it reimposed death penalties. So, you know, it's
slow progress.
It's slow progress here.
We go now to hear an acceptance speech by co-host Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael was awarded the 2007 Puffin Nation Prize for Creative Citizenship as one of the country's foremost defenders of human rights and civil liberties. He was honored for repeatedly challenging the Bush administration on the constitutionality of indefinite detentions and restrictions on domestic civil liberties. We go now to hear that speech.
Well, you can imagine I'm just completely thrilled and honored and moved to really be here among all of us and to really thank the Rosenstein family. And you know, there's a lot that's special about the award from them. One is, of course, the politics of the award, taking on the status quo, fighting for what's right and principled. But there's two parts of the award that are especially unique. One is, it's the first time I've ever gotten an award, or the center has gotten an award, where they didn't come to us and ask how many tables we could sell before we got the award. And the second part, of course, they're giving me a check, which is incredible and wonderful and for the center. So again, thank you, Perry, Gladys, and the Rosenstein family. It's really, really special. And of course, I want to thank my friends at The Nation, Victor, who I've known forever as an ally, Katrina, Ham, and of course The Nation itself, which has been supporters of the center and us of The Nation really since I was a lawyer in 1969 or 70, whenever I was at Columbia. And Jeremy, of course, is one of my heroes. As he said, we met when I was representing him and Amy after they'd been barred from a military base. But what they didn't tell you why they were barred. They went on as journalists, yes, and Amy, I'm sure, went on as a straight journalist. But what I learned at that moment when I met Jeremy was that he had been arrested, I had in my notes, 30 times. Jeremy corrected me and said, Michael, I think it was 40. Jeremy was what we call a militant Catholic worker. And he went on that base, I'm not sure he knew at the time, but he happened to be at the airplane when someone took up a hammer and hit it. And they covered that as a journalist, and somehow they thought that Jeremy might have known that happened before it did. And therefore they barred him from the base, but we won him. What, well, 40 times isn't bad, Jeremy. But anyway, but the other reason he's a hero to me, of course, is because of the pioneering work that he's done on really one of the greatest threats to our liberty, private armies, mercenary armies, Blackwater. His work led directly to the Center for Constitutional Rights case in which we have sued on behalf of the September victims of a murder that took place in Baghdad. It's an important lawsuit. It will hopefully begin to get at the bottom and begin to put a stop to what private contractors, private armies, are doing around the world. I want to say that in accepting this award, I don't stand here alone. I stand here really with the generations that have gone before me, those particularly at the Center for Constitutional Rights that have always been willing to upend the status quo and take personal and political risks. I stand especially on the shoulders of our founders of 40 years ago. Bill Kunstler, Morton Stavis, Arthur Kanoy, and Ben Smith. And one person who I think is here, of almost that generation, if he's here, he should stand up, Peter Weiss, wherever Peter is. And Peter Weiss, of course, well known for a lot of reasons, but recently he is the architect of the center's efforts to bring Rumsfeld and other administration criminals to justice in Europe. I'm also here with current and future generations as well. The people of the Center for Constitutional Rights, now led by Vince Warren, our executive director. And I'd like them to stand up. Where are they? Stand up, guys. They are doing some of the most difficult work that lawyers can do at Guantanamo on a weekly, monthly, daily basis, really, and around the world. They are the true heroes of the attempt to try and regain our Constitution. In some way, my greatest achievement at CCR is the confidence I have that they, the people at CCR today, are and will remain, as Alexander Coburn said of my CCR generation, a splendid band of tigerish people. That's what the center is, a splendid band of tigerish people. Over the last few years, I've become acquainted with a man named Henri Allègue. Henri Allègue is a French Algerian in his 80s who was water tortured, or as this administration says, waterboarded by the French. Here is how Henri Allègue described his water torture, a practice that goes back to the Inquisition. The rag was soaked rapidly. Water flowed everywhere, in my mouth, in my nose, all over my face. I tried, by contracting my throat, to take in as little water as possible and to resist suffocation by keeping air in my lungs as long as I could. But I couldn't hold on for more than a few minutes. I had the impression of drowning, and a terrible agony, that of death itself, took possession of me. Think about Henri Allègue when you hear the CIA talk about enhanced interrogation techniques. Or think about a terrible agony, that of death itself taking over you when you hear our new Attorney General refuse to condemn waterboarding. Or when you hear that some of our Democratic leaders were briefed and made not a peep of objection. Let there be no doubt, the Bush administration tortures, it disappears people, it holds people forever in offshore penal colonies like Guantanamo, it renders them to be tortured in other countries. This is what was done to CCR's client, Maher Arar, who was rendered to Syria for torture. And sadly, a majority of our Congress, our courts, and our media have given Bush a free hand, and in fact worse, have been the handmaidens of the torture and detention program. But it has not been given a free hand by the Center for Constitutional Rights. It has not been given a free hand by the nation. It has not been given a free hand by Jeremy or Naomi. Today, we're in the midst of a pitched battle to put this country back, at least ostensibly, on the page of fundamental rights and moral decency. The battle is difficult, and the road is long and hard. On occasion, I get pessimistic. Sometimes, I and my colleagues feel like Sisyphus. Twice, not just once, twice, we pushed the rock up the hill and won rights for Guantanamo detainees in the Supreme Court. And twice, the rock was rolled back down by Congress over those rights. So we pushed it back up again. We were in the Supreme Court for the third time. It was difficult, more difficult than before, because the justices have changed. Four are antediluvians, lost forever to humanity. But before I get us all depressed, we've had our victories. We've gotten lawyers to Guantanamo, stopped the most overt torture, and freed half of the Guantanamo detainees, over 300. We have gotten Maher Arar out of Syria. Canada has apologized for his torture, given him a substantial recovery in Canadian dollars, which is no embarrassment anymore. They said he was an innocent man, but he remains on the U.S. terror list. We have slowed, but not yet stopped, a remarkable grab for authoritarian power. I also don't lose hope because I think about the early days of Guantanamo. At first, we were few, but now we are many. At first, when CCR began, we were the lonely warriors taking on the Bush administration at Guantanamo. Now we are many. Now we, just on Guantanamo alone, are over 600 lawyers, most from major firms of every political stripe. These lawyers have an understanding of what is at stake, liberty itself. This struggle will be seen as one of the great chapters in the legal and political history of the United States. Today, war, torture, disappearances, murder surround us like plagues. Most in this country go on their way oblivious. Some don't want to know and are like ostriches. Some want to justify it all. Some want to make compromises. But be warned, we are at a tipping point into lawlessness and medievalism. We have our work to do. For each of us, the time for talking is long, long over. This is no time for compromise. No time for political calculation. As Howard Zinn admonishes us, it is the job of thinking people not to be on the side of the executioners. The Puffin Nation Prize reminds us all that the job for each of us is not to be on the side of the executioners. Thank you all.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.